I love getting to take Inforum on field trips, which is what this feels like right now. If you're new to us, our offices are actually up in kind of the Union Square TL border. So we're kind of at the end of the street away from Zendesk. Please come visit us if you're new. But I'm so excited to welcome you to tonight's program. Actually, I want to take a second, turn to the person next to you, hopefully you still have a drink in your hand, and cheers, and introduce yourself, because that's half of the fun of coming to our events. That's enough cheersing. There's more drinks after. There's more drinks after. Okay. I see this is why we don't let people drink before a lot of our events. I get it now. If this is your first time with us, I really hope it's not the last. You probably saw in the slideshow before, we've got a ton of events coming up. I love that a week from tonight, after I do a cocktail program, we're hosting the U.S. Chief Data Scientist, DJ Patil. So we really run the full gamut of what you can learn and do here in San Francisco. If you want to get involved tonight, we have amazing volunteers, amazing staff here. They make all of our programs possible. Come talk to one of us and learn how you can get involved. We're actually moving into a new home at the end of this year down on the Embarcadero. So we're always really excited to hear what else we can be doing and how we can get you into our new home later this year as well. Like I mentioned, great programs coming up. U.S. Chief Data Scientist next Wednesday. Charles Duhigg and his book Smarter, Better, Faster. If you're familiar with Power of Habit on the 9th. We'll have a sustainable fashion program from Levi on May 17th and the CEO of Stella and Dot on May 26th. And that's just before the end of May. And those are just my programs. We do about 450 programs a year at the club. So if you want to learn something, we're your place to do it. And I'm stealing the NPR Live thing from Tiffany. I like it. Now, one other thing, you don't need to turn off your cell phones, just your ringers. We do encourage tweeting and Facebooking. I hope to see a million Instagrams of every drink that you get to have in your hands tonight, so make that happen. We are in Forum SF on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, so please feel free to get involved there. We've also got an awesome raffle, and I think a lot of our in-kind sponsors for that are in the house. We've got stuff from Williams-Sonoma, Bitters and Bottles, Seven Stills, a book written by Matthew here at Zendesk, who I think is also in the audience, and he signed it for you, and actually a copy of our moderator's book tonight. So enter to win. We're going to pull at the end of the night, but there's still time to buy a raffle ticket after you've had yet another drink. That's when I really like to sell raffle tickets. So, and now it is my absolute pleasure to introduce tonight's moderator, J.K. Dineen, who is an SF Chronicle reporter and the author of High Spirits, a book about cocktail culture himself, and the Future Bars team of Doug Dalton and Brian Sheehy.
Welcome, everyone. And thank you, Tiffany. We worked together years ago at the Examiner, not far from here, across the street. It's a good time to be having a conversation about the Bay Area's growing cocktail culture. I mean, the city has added 100,000 jobs in the last 5 years, around 50,000 people, and along with that has come a plethora of new drinking establishments and restaurants, and also a lot of tension over, you know, what the city is and who it serves and what the future will bring. So I have a particularly fond attachment to Future Bars and Brian in particular. Doug, I just met tonight, but when I arrived in San Francisco in July 23rd, 2002, the San Francisco Examiner was located in the Warfield Building, now home to Spotify and Benchmark Capital, and the new Equator shop. We had floors 6, 7, and 8. And my first assignment was to go down and see what these two crazy Irish kids were doing down on 6th Street. They had opened a place called Anu, and nobody could figure out why or what they thought they were doing. And so I wandered in, and I was the only customer. Kind of looked around, wasn't sure if anybody was working, and met, you know, Brian was probably sanding something, or, you know, he and the late Dahi Donnelly, Brian's original partner, were very hands-on, and it turned out that he and I shared in common Boston as a place of birth, and also County Kerry, Ireland, as I had spent many of my formative years going there, and knew many people that he knew in Ireland as well. And so I must admit that the first, my first month or two in San Francisco, I was pretty much head on you most of the time. And sometimes I was the only customer. And Brian and Dahi were just, you know, my first kind of friends here, besides the ink-stained wretches that I worked with at the Examiner, who also tended to flock to the bar after work, after deadline was over. So, you know, then they went on, as everybody knows, to open Swig up on Geary and many other places, and their reputation has grown. They really revolutionized, cocktail culture in San Francisco and kind of invented it in many ways. So, Brian, I wanted to start with you. How did two gentlemen from Ireland end up at 43 6th Street, a stone's toss from here, not the unscruffiest block in San Francisco? Did you guys end up there because it was cheap, or you thought it might be, you know, up and coming, or what?
Well, it was a different time in San Francisco, when newspapers were still powerful and strong, and their employees were well paid. And it was the only bar in our history that we've actually had to close. We saved the license, but your tab, we still have it. We have three tabs, and we'll probably frame them and put them up at the Lark, which was formerly Dave's Bar. The tabs are definitely in their thousands. One was for J.K. Janine. One was for Warren Henkel, and the longest tab is for Richard Byrne Riley, who some of you will remember. Some great characters. So we ended up on 6th Street with this first bar, mostly because our original partner, Dahi Donnelly, he was a very, very strong man, strong personality. He wanted to be his own boss, but he knew he needed somebody from Kerry to execute the plan, which is why he partnered with me. I worked a couple blocks away at the Marriott Hotel, the big jukebox, a wonderful organization, and I too wanted to be my own boss, but I didn't know anything about the bar business. He did. He had already worked at a famous Irish bar in town here called the Irish Bank. That's where he learned the ins and outs of operating a bar in the San Francisco environment. And between us, we put our few dollars of savings together, and we were able to purchase this bar, which at the time was called Ginger's Trois, owned by a famous barkeeper of San Francisco history from the 60s and 70s. His name was Don Rogers, and I can share it now because it's a long time ago. We bought that bar for $45,000. not a bad investment.
How much was the license?
The license was worth $20,000, and today that license is worth at least $275,000. That street, it wasn't all roses for us, though. That street was known as Skid Row at the time. The city has changed a lot, and maybe it's still not the most pleasant street in town, but I can tell you in 2002, it was not pleasant at all. But it worked for us, and luckily we made all of our bartending mistakes on a small scale, and we worked from there.
What were some of those mistakes?
Well, being in our 20s, being from Ireland with our cute accents, my wife is sitting in the front row here, so I can't explain too much about it. we got in a lot of trouble. There's a Lieutenant Dave Falzon. He's a friend of ours in the police department here, and he probably wouldn't be too proud to hear that the bar actually didn't close at 2 in the morning every night. But
I'm shocked to hear that, especially the basement.
Don't mention the basement.
He had a boxing area, training area, and some IRA memorabilia. I'm wondering whether there were things that, I mean, that was the DJ era. Talk about that. I mean, you guys were into infused drinks and DJs. Are you still into that stuff?
We're still into the infused drinks on a different type of scale. We're not into the DJs as much. At that time in the early 2000s, that's what people did when they went out. We used to have drum and bass parties, and it was all about house music. I wasn't a major fan of it myself. I didn't know it from A to Z, not a clue, but they really had some characters that were DJs that would travel in from, usually from the UK or from the East Coast, People like Danny Howells, the famous names from the 90s and 2000s, Sasha and Digweed, if any of you remember those guys. But most of all, the best fun that we had at ANU was when a current Zendesk employee of yours, a colleague of yours, used to come in and just rip this town apart. And his name is Sean Cusick, and he went by the DJ name of Q6 at the time. And he was a notorious character, and he really helped put us on the map. Because when he would leave town, J.K. Richard Byrne Riley would have to write about it the next day in the Examiner, and it really helped drive a lot of traffic to this little bar on 6th Street, where you could go to the large clubs like 1015 Folsom and Ruby Sky and pay maybe $20 or $30 to go see these DJs and be one of 2,000 or 3,000 people. But you could come to this little bar on 6th Street called ANU, and you would be one of maybe 60 or 70 people and have the same experience with these DJs in such a close, hospitable environment. So it worked out for us at the time.
Yeah, one of the things that I remember this time very particularly is I sat next to this DJ, and I asked him, hey, so you're a DJ? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, what's your day job? And he's like, I made $1.8 million on my last album. I'm like, oh, what's your name? And he's like, Tiesto. I'm like, that's a catchy name.
Well, I wanted to bring Doug into it now, and also sort of find out how you started working. First started working at ANU, and I'm interested in what you guys learned about the business in terms of, you know, creating community and the business model that you were able to then apply to going forward to Swig and then Rickhouse and the other places that you've opened since.
Yeah, I mean, one of the key things that I actually was going to open a bar right down the street from Brian and Dahi. And that is now called, what's it called?
Monarch.
So I was going to buy the club that was formerly called POW, and it's now Monarch. And I think one of the things I was introduced by a mutual friend to Brian and Dahi, and we just hit it off on this idea. I had just been living in New York for about 2.5 years, and we both had an idea of how the bar should be very, very different than what the current culture of bars were in San Francisco. And I think one of the things that we noticed is that there was a very huge difference in like high-end restaurants and then kind of dive bars. And San Francisco kind of embraced this dive bar culture at the time. And Brian Dahi and I saw a real opening to do something in between a restaurant and a dive bar. And I think we really jumped on that.
So what were some of the qualities from a, you know, fine eating establishment that you thought would work in more of a drinking setting? Was it like privacy or the dependability on a table, that kind of thing?
Well, I think the big thing was, really focusing on hospitality and also focusing on the quality of the product. One thing that you notice when you go into a restaurant, there's so much attention around the meal that you're getting. And we really wanted to bring that same attention level to the cocktails that you were having and make that environment really enticing and unique and kind of escapist from the rest of what you see outside. So while Brian talks about the colorful nature of the outside of ANU, the inside of ANU was just absolutely wonderful. And it was a very unique environment. And then as we started to grow on to Swig and mature onto Bourbon and Branch, it doesn't matter what the area is around it or outside of it. We really felt like the interior, once you came, the dichotomy of the outside versus the interior really changed people's perception and really made them feel a part of what was going on inside.
Great. So I'm kind of curious to segue into kind of the current scene in San Francisco. What are the drinking habits of all? I mean, everybody talks about techies and tech workers, and I'm
what
sure
habit?
A lot of people who, and you have technology, right?
I do.
So I'm kind of curious, you know, where is cocktail culture right now? What are the young people who are arriving here by the Google bus load, what are they drinking? I mean, a shot and a beer or something more highly concocted?
One of my first jobs the Bay Area was at Netscape. So I was a lead engineer at Netscape. And I actually got the pleasure of working with someone who's been here for about 5 years. His name is Nathan Raffeld. And one of the just to give him a big plug, is he drew the original Mozilla that became part of Netscape culture. I think one of the big things that I've noticed through the influx of technology people is they've always been here. I mean, I would say while there's a new generation, Sun Microsystems, all these companies have been around forever. And I think the big thing that people have really kind of started to focus on is the higher end, more hard find spirits. So they're looking for things that are very unique, very original, like barrel aged gins and very floral mezcals and things that are hard to find, but they're really looking for something unique as opposed to just your traditional Jack Daniels, Jim Beam, you know, shot in a beer type things.
But what about traditionally, Brian, maybe you could answer this. I mean, the people that hung out in downtown bars were, you know, they sold insurance, they leased buildings for real estate companies, they were lawyers, they worked at banks, exciting things like that. How are their do they drink more than these people that have to catch the Google bus in the morning, or less, or how is it different?
I don't think so. This is a changing town, but the drinking habits really haven't changed that much. People still drink a lot. A lot of people drink way too much. But the change is people have a lot more money to be spending now. So it definitely has gone to the higher levels on the back bar shelf. That's where people are spending the money. But our little local neighborhood bar, which we call Lark, that's a bar for everybody, regardless of your background or what your paycheck is written on it. And it's still a very affordable luxury. You can go to the Lark Bar and have an Anchor Lager for $4 at happy hour, or you can go to Pagan Idol and have a Mai Tai for $12. It's a very, very affordable luxury. The cost of living here has gone through the roof. We all know that. The traffic is crazy. There are a lot more people here, but the bars are very, very busy, and it's a great time to be in San Francisco. There's a lot of money going around. There's still a lot of hardships, of course, but we've always had that here. But it's a celebration of this golden era of San Francisco right now. And what we're finding is San Franciscans that are successful, whether they're in the tech business or they're bankers or they're social workers, they're celebrating these great times, and we just hope that it'll continue for a few more years.
Let's talk about Bourbon and Branch. I think that was in some ways the place that put you guys on the map. First you had Anew, and then Swig was a beautiful bar. It was very modern. It had a fireplace and it definitely was a step up, but it was really Bourbon and Branch with its kind of speakeasy vibe and reservations and a whole bunch of things that hadn't really existed in San Francisco. Did you guys know that it was going to take off like it did, or?
We had no idea that it would be, as people say, as successful as it has been. We're coming up on its 10-year anniversary, but at the time for myself and Doug and Dahi, we were very, very lucky. We were at the right place at the right time. Among a certain group of bartenders in San Francisco at the time, there was a craving for them to show off the capabilities that they had. And some of them, people like Todd Smith, Dominic Venegas, John Santer, Ryan Fitzgerald, these were senior bartenders in the Bay Area working at restaurant bars. And they had this craving and this desire to all work together in an environment where they could show off the knowledge that they had built up over the years. And the excitement that they had was our challenge. We had to build a space around them, set it up, open the doors, and get out of their way. And we tried that at Swig. We had infusions. We tried a cocktail program, and we would shove it in people's faces when they would show up. We would say, okay, a beer is $5, but if you have this cocktail handcrafted, And we were probably one of the first bars to ever mention the two words small batch, which is everywhere now, even on the plastic seats you're sitting on there. People just didn't want it. They wanted vodka Red Bull. Unfortunately, that was it, and we just couldn't change people's attitudes. So we got to know the owner of the building where Bourbon Branch is now, Chuck Custer, and we had to actually convince him to allow us to put a bar in there. There had been a bar there for 40 years. It was called the 501 Club, operated by a wonderful lady from Korea called Song Wright. And we had to spend a year convincing her to sell to us, even though she had no customers.
How did you do that? Like,
We drank a lot of Coronas with no limes. And with a deadline, my fiance at the time used to come and pick us up on the dot at midnight and get us out of there before the real bad things would happen. But we were able to help her into her retirement. It was obvious she could barely pay the rent, and we got to know the landlord, and he wanted to put a Starbucks in there. And he just couldn't understand why Starbucks were not willing to pay $30 a square foot for the corner of Jones and O'Farrell. We told him that we would do it, and we would put the bar in, and he'd give us a chance. So we got the space. We built it out in the style of the 1920s, speakeasy. Fortunately for us, as I keep saying, we were very lucky. The day that we got the keys from Song Wright, there were two keys on it, one key for the front door and a second key for a trap door at the end of the bar. And we said, well, what's this key for? And she said, it's for that trap door right there. And I said, well, can we go down and take a look? Is this part of the deal? And she said, absolutely, but I haven't been down there in 28 years because it's haunted. So she left, and immediately myself and Dahi had to open up the trap door. We went down. It was pitch black, so we had to run across to the convenience store that's still there, got some light bulbs. We came back.
Actually, Dahi fell down the steps. We almost thought we lost him.
Yeah. Well, we got down there. But I was going to say something about another female that was involved at that time, but she did not push him down the stairs. We got down there and we screwed the light bulbs in, flicked the switch, and we just couldn't believe it. There's a speakeasy in the basement of this bar that we just purchased, and we couldn't believe it. Canvas walls, beautifully painted, looking like it's a scene from Tuscany. We would have preferred to have a scene from West Kerry, but it was Tuscany. We weren't being picky at that stage. And we found the bar, we found a number of artifacts inside there. And as we did our construction over the next few months and years, we found wonderful newspapers from the 1920s and early 1930s, the era of Prohibition. And we actually found a purse. Some people would call it a man bag, like our man over there, Brian Ueda from Future Bars. He has a collection of them. Inside in this bag, we can't tell if it was a female's bag or a male's bag, but inside it we found a treasure trove, photos of this lady by the name of Lorraine Adeline Wilson. Also, her wallet was in there, her pocketbook, and it had her license, which was handwritten. It showed each of the locations that she had lived in. It had her perfume, her lipstick, a couple of letters from her aunt, a letter that she was about to mail, and a variety of other items. And it was dated. There were two ticket stubs to a theater on this block here, an old cinema theater, and she had gone with somebody else to see the Lucky Gang. And we still have all of that. And that's how lucky we are. We bought a bar in the depths of the Tenderloin at Jones and O'Farrell. We found a speakeasy, and then it was authenticated with a treasure trove like this. So it worked out well.
I remember running into you around that time at the Alemany flea market. And I was like, what are you doing, Brian? And you said, oh, you're buying stuff for the new bar. Like, what were you looking for?
So at that time, there weren't a lot of places to go and find vintage cocktailware, vintage shakers, lamps from the 1920s, old books. We had to collect thousands and thousands of books to put in our library bar for any of you that have been to Bourbon and Branch. We didn't want to put the fake wallpaper up like they did at the W Hotel. Was that the W Hotel? My wife worked there. That's okay. We wanted the real thing, and we went all over the Bay Area to flea markets and bargain stores to collect all of this paraphernalia that actually was from the 20s and 30s, because we wanted the authentic experience to go along with the great drinks that these phenomenal bartenders that we had just met were going to produce for us. So that's why we spent a lot of time at the flea markets and antique shows.
And one thing that we did as well at that location is we've worked with this one artist for quite some time. His name is Ivan Mora, and he helped offset kind of the antiquity of the bar, but with incredible glass sculptures that have followed us all around. And we've been very fortunate. He's worked with us over and over and over again. But that big interior glass sculpture that you see right as you come into Bourbon and Branch is what Ivan had done. And I think it's really great to have that kind of nuevo experience as well as the antiquity of the bar and the historical aspect.
I think that's a good segue also. You know, you guys, your bars are really, to me, performances. I just wrote this book about, kind of legacy bars of San Francisco, where I'm really focused on kind of continuity of culture and community, which is a totally different thing from what you guys do, which is kind of harken back to the certain eras in the city's history and kind of recreate that. And you hire these people with, you know, suspenders and these cool old shirts and tattoos who throw things around and, you know, they're like actors in a way. And to me, it seems like that started at Bourbon and Branch and then just kind of accelerated from there. And since then you've got bars that span different eras, right? In terms of like vibe and the atmosphere. Can you talk a little bit about kind of how that whole sort of aesthetic came together?
Sure. Well, with the design of the bar, we were sticklers for sticking to the designs of the 1920s and the early 1930s. And we wanted to be a speakeasy bar, not a modern version of a speakeasy. We were sitting on the side of a speakeasy, and we had a historian by the name of Jim Jarvis that went back and through all of the telephone books of San Francisco going back to the 1870s. And he was able to give us documented evidence that there's been a bar there since 1865. So we're just stewards of this bar at 501 Jones for a short couple of decades, hopefully, if we are able to keep it going like it is. So we were able to share that with the bartenders and our designers and anybody who was working on it, that we wanted to create a bar that if you walked into it in 1921 or 1933, it should look like that and feel like that. And we didn't want any TVs. We didn't want any beer signs or liquor signs. We just wanted it to be an inviting environment. And we had some rules of the house that we had to institute. We started with 10, but very quickly we had to reduce that to 9. One got out of control. I can tell you about that later. Actually, I'll tell you now. The first rule of the house was the bartender is always right. Well, the bartender's not always right. I can tell you that. But we had rules of the house, and the second rule was you can't use your phone. This was a long time ago when people still had the small little phones that didn't have the bright lights and all of the apps that we have today. But we wanted it to be a place where people could focus on the guests that they arrived with. And we built the bar around that philosophy, where it would be a space to get away, escapism. So you walk down maybe from the Clift Hotel or the Hotel Monaco or the Hilton, you walk one block through a pretty sketchy neighborhood at the time, and you arrive at this door. You have to press the buzzer and hope that that door opens quickly, because there are probably some people eyeing you on the corner, and give the password, step inside, breathe a sigh of relief, and then when you step inside, that's when you are about to experience the ultimate in hospitality in 2002 when we opened that bar. So we wanted to take the hospitality experiences that guests were finding at places like the Clift and the Monaco and the W and all the great hotels in town. And we wanted to put that in a bar environment. It's almost like an extension of the hotel, but just a couple blocks away from the lobby of the hotel. And some of the bartenders that we were fortunate enough to have join us had spent years working in wonderful hotel bars, and they were able to just turn that on. And it really was the bartenders that said to us, you know, if we're going to do this 1920s speakeasy thing, we have to do it right. We have to dress like bartenders from the Prohibition era. And it was their idea to wear the fedoras. It was their ideas to wear the bow ties and the white shirts. And I can tell you, at Bourbon Branch, we're not responsible for all the tattoos, because we wanted them to have their sleeves rolled down, just to have that elevated level of service that came later. We can't take any responsibility for that.
All right. So what I'd like to do now is throw out the name of your various bars and have you guys kind of in a couple of sentences describe the era, the vibe, the aesthetic that you were going after? How about traditions?
Tradition is a celebration of drinking in America. When you walk inside there, you can see hundreds and hundreds of beautiful ads, art actually, that we've collected over the years. Many of the brands have been gone for years and years and decades, but when you look closely at those ads, you can see the craftsmanship that went into them, the dedication that those artists had, and we can just in our minds imagine the hundreds and hundreds of people that worked behind those brands, and those brands came to an end. We know that Trad and Bourbon and Branch and all of our bars are going to come to an end someday, but in the meantime, we have to make the most of it, and that's just a reminder. Also, there are some great ads on the wall of tradition for some brands that are still around today, but they maybe only have come back in the last couple of years. Some of the most beautiful ads are for Old Crow Whiskey. You actually have to go to Bourbon, go to Trad to see these ads. They're wonderful works of art, and these were pieces of ad artwork that were produced in the 20s and 30s in the middle of Prohibition. I don't know where they were selling those ads or where they were posting those ads, but they were still making ads in the 20s and 30s. Wonderful works of art. And those are brands that had died out in the 30s and 40s, and they're only back now in the 5, 6, 7 years. It's just a delight to see those old stories, old histories. Some of the history is gone with no chance of coming back, but a lot of those histories are being resurrected at a little place like Trad.
And one of the other things that's great about Trad is every single one of the little the nooks that are throughout the bar are themed after a very specific type of bar, such as a hotel bar or a tiki bar, and really, really embracing kind of bar culture in general.
They're also kind of a 60s British, like, rock and roll vibe there, too. Did I pick that up? No?
You must have come to one of our pop-ups. That English guy got recently deported. I'm just kidding. He didn't.
Okay. All right. How about Tupper and Reed? That's the Berkeley bar.
Tupper and Reed is really a celebration of music. So the original concept around Tupper and Reed, it's two gentlemen who started the first music store in Berkeley. It was started in the early 1900s, and their names are still actually on little gargoyles on the outside, T&R. Almost every famous musician that comes from the Bay Area went to Tupper and Reed at one point or another. So really what we looked for is Brian and I went throughout the Bay Area online, wherever we could, to try and find items that were sold from Tupper and Reed from that era. And we were able to. So a lot of the Victrolas and things that you see throughout the bar, you'll actually see a little monogram on the back that says Tupper and Reed or sold by Tupper and Reed, which is really, really phenomenal, especially because we actually bought the name and the rights to the company from one of the original owners. And we have the original sign that's actually hanging in the office.
All right. How about the new one? The
Pagan Idol?
Pagan Idol, the Tiki Bar.
Well, I'm going to say that really is a fantastic bar. The other bars are good, but this is a fantastic and an exciting project for us. We have some unbelievable people working at that bar. It's almost operated like a deserted island. We don't have dedicated servers or hosts or hostesses or floor managers. Everybody works there as a bartender. And when you arrive there, we want to transport you on a cruise, get you on board where you arrive at the captain's quarters, have a beverage there. You'll be invited to go through the door and you'll arrive at a Polynesian island. And that is when you're going to forget completely about what's happening outside. And you can imagine yourself being in Maui on a summer's night, looking up at Haleakala, the volcano that's going to erupt. We have koi fish in there, wonderful tikis, a starlit ceiling. And behind it all, the drinks are really, really wonderful. But it's the levels of hospitality that each member of that staff are able to present to our guests is what's so delightful for myself and Doug. People tell us that we're in the bar business, but really we're not. We're in the hospitality business. And the two leaders of that bar, Daniel Parks is a tiki fanatic. He was a beverage director at Trader Vic's for many years across the bay. And similar to Bourbon Branch, with his guidance and in association with his colleague, our bar manager there, the general manager, J- Justin Dolly, who comes from Hawaii. These guys epitomize having a great time in a bar, which is almost coming full circle. You don't have to read the ingredients on the menu of what went into the drink. You just point at that funny looking pink drink there and say, I'll have three of those. And it works. And these guys have done a wonderful job. It's been a joy to work with them. And if you have not been there yet, you should make a reservation to go there.
All right. Let's go faster through the rest of them because you guys have too many bars. How about Local Edition, just in a couple of sentences?
Well, Local Edition, my grandfather was actually a newspaper reporter, and that is all about newspaper heritage and the newspaper legacy of San Francisco. It's in the basement of the Hearst building. It's William Hearst's first building in the city. And so I'll keep it brief, but it is the publishing floor of the Examiner. So when you walk through there, there are a lot of artifacts, including the projector that supposedly William Randolph Hearst did not see Citizen Kane on.
And where did you guys get all that stuff? I mean, you have Steve Hearst, who has an office in the building. I don't know if you guys read last week, the San Francisco Chronicle reported, I reported that the Hearst building, which is at Third and Market, is going to become a hotel, a boutique hotel. And when I asked the developers about it, they pointed to Local Edition in the basement and said, we kind of want to do what they're doing, except for like the whole building. So they were inspired by Doug and Brian. And Steve Hearst, I think he said that you guys found stuff that his family didn't even have in terms of old editions of the Examiner.
Yeah, Steve Hearst, he runs a Hearst company here in the West Coast, and he's been a wonderful supporter of ours over the years. He loves his history. Obviously, he comes from one of the most famous families in the history of America, and it's a privilege for us to have two bars and our cast door in that family's building. To watch the Hearst family, whom on opening day, Steve Hearst cut the tape for us, and he definitely had a couple of tears in his eyes when he was able to go downstairs and see the invigorated space, which is now Local Edition, which used to house the printing presses for the San Francisco Examiner for 75 years. These have been turbulent times for the newspaper business, as you well know, JK. But we were able to do something special there that is set in stone at this stage. It's one of the busiest bars that we have in our group, maybe in the city. And we have hundreds of people going through there every evening, reading newspapers going back to the 1870s when the Examiner first went into print. And that's just a joy for the Hearst family and the people that work at Hearst. And they have a whole building above us, and they see that history is inside those walls. Jack London worked there for so many years, and so many great writers. Mark Twain worked in that building for so many years. So they want to invigorate that building. Converting it to a hotel, you know, it's going to be a lot of work. There's going to be a lot of frustrations, a lot of challenges for the tenants that are currently in there. But the Hearst family are very, very fair, and they have a lot of vision, and we just are working with them to be a part of the further invigoration of that beautiful building.
Well, obviously, bars are very public places. The word pub comes from public house. It's they're places where people, you know, celebrate, births of their kids and deaths of their friends and weddings and divorces and everything else. So lately there's been a raft of places that have closed or been sold, and a lot of hand-wringing, probably fueled by social media more than anything else, about, you know, oh my God, you know, what will San Francisco be like without, you know, the Lexington Club or the Estanoche or Dave's in the case. And that sort of led to, a lot of people saying, you know, complaining about gentrification and the changing city and where has my San Francisco gone. I know that there was a mayoral candidate who kind of gave you guys a hard time about having purchased Dave's. So I'm just kind of interested in getting your response to that line of thinking and if you could kind of tell us what you've done with Dave's.
Sure. Well, it's an immense change that's happening in the city. but it's a city that's always been changing. And outside of our bars, Dave's was my favorite bar. And about a month after Bourbon and Branch opened, Steve Hurst made a reservation at Bourbon and Branch, and he came in with his right-hand man, Marty. And the very next day, they contacted Doug and said, we want you guys to do this at the Hearst building. And that was a long time ago. So this has been in the works for a long time. But change is going to happen, and we can't stop it. Doug and I know that we're stewards of the bars that we operate at our locations right now. But at some point, somebody else is going to get the keys to those bars, and they're going to be tasked with the responsibility of maybe continuing a legacy or shutting it down and building something entirely new there. Bars are very special places, but I had some great conversations with Dave Supple about this transition, which is very, very frustrating for him. He was the steward of that bar at the Hearst building for 28 years. But before he became the steward, there was somebody else there, an owner that operated the Ticker Tape for 12 years. And before it was the Ticker Tape, it was another bar for about 20 years. So change happens. People have mentioned the Lexington Club and, you know, O'Reilly's in North Beach, which was another great bar. There's no stopping that. It's going to happen. And hopefully the people that get to take over these locations or are fortunate enough or lucky enough to get the keys to these locations have some sense of history and a sense of the responsibility of making sure that the same type of service is operated for the people that have been going there for, in our case, 28 years going to Dave's. We respect what Dave and his crew did at that location. I remember years ago in the late 90s when I worked at the Marriott Hotel as a sales guy, I would take my clients there after doing it, you know, after signing a contract. That was the place to celebrate. And it's an honor for Doug and I and Future Bars to be in that location. We honor Dave. There's, you know, the door is open for him anytime that he comes. And some of his guests have come back and have expressed that they're pleased that we haven't completely transformed the place. We've made some subtle changes to the place, but you can still get all of the same products that Dave offered. But change happens, and it's going to continue.
And one other thing that I'd like to add is throughout all of our bars, one of the things that we've Brian and I have tried to do is keep some of the character of or the legacy of all the locations previously. So, for example, at Swig, every Sunday night we have a blues jam, and that has been going since the late 1970s. And then at Jazz at Pearls, we continue to have jazz bands play there that have played there throughout the history of the bar. I think that's something that we really respect is the people who were there before us, and we like to keep some of the character that they had at that bar before. Even if the concept may change slightly, we definitely like to keep the heritage of the location.
Do you have regulars from some of the previous incarnations?
Oh, absolutely. Like yourself.
Could you, I guess let's talk a little bit about policy and politics. Is there anything that, what is the state of nightlife in the city? Are there things that the city could do to improve nightlife, to make, your business go more smoothly?
Well, this is San Francisco, and if you want to open a bar, you better do it in San Francisco. We have a friend, his name is Blandford Stockdale. He's a great fisherman. He says his motto in life is you have to fish where the fish are. And in the bar business, the fish are in San Francisco. And sure, there's always more that the government can do. But if you're determined and you have a certain amount of luck and you're willing to work hard, you're going to figure out how to get through the red tape. Every city has rules. They have policies. They have laws. You just have to use your time wisely and work on your relationships with all the different city agencies, whether it's with the police department, the fire department, the entertainment commission, the building department, the planning department. You've got to let those people know who you know. And if you're a responsible operator, that's going to be recognized. And over time, you just have to keep at it. Sure, there are frustrations, but we figure out how to deal with them.
All right, we got 5 more minutes before we go to questions. What makes a good bartender?
First and foremost, when we interview a bartender, the first question is, would you like to have a drink with that person? And if the answer is yes, they're off to a good start. A lot of people interview very well, and it might not turn out that way when they get behind the stick. But we hire people that we would like to have serve us. Or if Doug's mom comes to visit from home, or my dad or mom come and they go into any of our bars and we're not with them, well, is that bartender going to serve them very well and be hospitable and humble?
And the other thing that we can tell very early on, especially with our locations, is if they're passionate about the products, if they have things that they enjoy, things that they love, and they start speaking about them right away, it's something you can tell, and you can tell the excitement behind them. If they don't have that excitement, then that's not something that we want.
How long does the typical bartender work for you guys?
Well, luckily our bars are busy, and a huge proportion of the income of our bar staff comes from tips. So the challenge that Doug and I have is to provide bars that are busy for our staff. We have some of our bar managers here tonight, and they can tell you we have a wait list of people that want to fortunately work for us at our bars because they are busy. With a collection of bars, no bartender should ever get bored working at one location. So you could start out at Swig and progress to Bourbon Branch, and maybe the next year you want to work at Local Edition or go on a vacation and work at Pagan Idol. So plenty of opportunities for staff.
How about the cost of living in San Francisco is not cheap? Do you lose bartenders to like Portland or other cheaper cities?
I think one of the things that we found more is not so much people getting or losing to the cost of living. We've just had extremely successful and incredible staff who have worked with us. So some of our staff you'll see on shows like Bar Rescue, and we've had other staff go on to be top brand ambassadors for some of the biggest brands in the world.
Cool. All right, I want like one or two word answers. Where do you guys hang out when you're not at Future Bar Bars?
At home with my wife and kids.
A bar, come on. No.
I do like Specs, and no, we're not going to buy it.
Yeah, I would say probably one of the bars that I go to often is Brass Tacks because it's very close to my house. I can stumble home.
Do you have a favorite or least favorite cocktail trend right now? Maybe Fireball.
A cocktail trend that I don't like? I can tell you I read recently about a bartender who has been scouring the grassy median strips of Van Ness looking for fennel pollen. We're not going to be drinking that cocktail, so that trend is not going to happen.
Yeah, I would say that in the era of what you would say hypnotic and drinks that are more sugar-oriented, I'm not a fan of those. On the other hand, cocktails that I'm in the fan of, there's a trend right now that I absolutely love, which is the trend towards mezcal replacing whiskey. And I think that a lot of really inventive drinks have come up in that area.
Is there a secret late-night eating place that you guys know about that we don't?
My fridge. My fridge.
All right. Questions now? Yeah, so we've got a bunch of time for questions. So.
I heard that, Brian, you made an app. Did you make an app?
Yes, well, Doug is the CTO of our company, so maybe I can explain it. We've spent not too much time working on this app. But it's not actually cloud-based, it's crowd-based, and we're releasing it to the audience here right now. Hopefully some of you have experienced it already. Looks like you have. Doug can explain it further.
Yeah, it's called Decanter of Whiskey.
So we have one here, and no, there's not one for everybody in the audience. So this is our app.
It's very straightforward.
Once you've downloaded it, you open the top, pour it into the other device in your hand that's not your smartphone, and please give us 5-star reviews.
We have another question from the back.
Hi, fellas. With respect to the preservation of a lot of these historical spots, which you're owning and taking over and essentially making better for the next generation, you're attracting a different set of locals, which might have gone from what the city may think of as funky San Francisco to young millennials walking into Local Edition and Tradition. Where is the accountability or onus on the bartender or of the bar to to tell this tribal history, to tell the new generation of your guests the history of your bar and why it's important.
Well, I think that a lot of that is when hopefully the atmosphere that we have created elicits a curiosity in what we're doing. But then as well, I mean, we're talking about a technology city. All of our websites do tell the story of what we created, and hopefully they go there before and are curious to come in and see what the environment is that matches the story that we're telling. And I think a lot of people, San Francisco, one of the things that Brian and I have tried to do is we really believe that San Francisco as a culture is a word of mouth culture. And we don't advertise, we don't go into papers or any of that, because we really feel like it's the value of your friends and your friends' recommendations and them giving you that story to really drive you to a location, really and give you that sense of ownership of really finding something unique.
And I would also add on to that, those millennials that you mentioned that are going to our bars every day of the week, those millennials are going to be in their 30s and 40s at some point, and they'll probably still live in San Francisco, and they're still going to be going to bars, and by then our bars will probably be old news anyway.
We have a question from John Tay in the back.
Hi, guys. Love your bars, of course. What can you, with respect to Bourbon and Branch, what can you tell us about the Anti-Saloon League?
So the Anti-Saloon League was the political lobby that pushed for prohibition in the lead up to 1921. They were a very successful organization. Every little town, village, and city in the U.S. had a chapter of the Anti-Saloon League. In the lead up to prohibition, there really was a lot of excessive drinking in the United States and a lot of drinking of terrible products. Luckily, we don't have that as much anymore. But in San Francisco, they had their own chapter of the Anti-Saloon League. So when we were opening Bourbon Branch, there was a sign outside the building that said the 501 Club. And we were advised by our friends in government not to remove the structure of the sign because we would never be allowed to put it back up. Now, being a speakeasy, we couldn't put our Bourbon Branch logo up there. So we had to come up with something that would be a little deceptive, but would be a wink and a nod to the history buffs, which is why we put the Anti-Saloon League sign up there, and we gave the impression that 501 Jones, our address of Bourbon Branch, was actually the chapter of the Anti-Saloon League. So we probably have some people that turned in their graves.
You ever have like teetotalers show up like for meetings or?
No, not those teetotalers.
Another question from stage left.
Hi, yeah. I was wondering, in your eyes and taste buds, what do you guys think makes a great cocktail, and besides the balance of it?
Well, one of the things that I think is really good of when you go into a space, I feel like you, trust the bartender and what they're going to give you. But then one thing that I feel is if it's too heavily spirit forward and that's all you taste is the spirit, and you don't get any of the other flavors that they're putting into it, I think that's, again, what you said, balance is, I think, the most important thing. But I also feel people who go into a bar, you immediately have a go-to drink that you truly enjoy. And if that one comes out really, really well, then you know to trust the bartender on making something unique and something maybe outside of your wheelhouse that you're willing to try.
Another question right here from Liz. Hi. I just downloaded your app.
How would you rate it?
I had a really good user experience.
Thank you.
And that's not my usual user experience with apps. So I was curious about the development that went into it.
It was a long process.
We'll leave this to our CTO.
Well, I think we took a lot of time thinking about it and not a lot of time really thinking about exactly how it would be used. So there's multiple ways that it could be used, but I'm glad your experience was great. Hopefully you'll share it with those around you.
And we thought about doing a Kickstarter campaign, but we ran out of time. So the great thing about this app is you only have to pay for it on your departure. So we'll be standing at the door collecting donations.
We have a question stage right from Chelsea.
Hi. A lot of your bars are inspired by the location or the person who was previously in the bar, but are there any cultures or decades that you want to explore and you haven't yet with your bar programs?
One thing that I think has been really interesting for us is Devil's Acre is one of our bars that Brian and I focus very heavily on. We went to the Apothecary Museum in New Orleans, and we really got into the apothecary culture. And I feel like there is a lot more in that area that we could explore, and a lot more that was kind of pre that era. But I don't know, Brian.
Well, I would say the pendulum it's almost swung all the way back to the dive bar again. So 70s and 80s bar are probably going to be the next thing, but those probably won't happen until we have our market correction.
Right, yeah.
Another question in the back from Matthew.
It's so clear that you both and that what your work is comes from a great love of bars and a great appreciation for bar culture and bar history. And why is that important to you? And what do you think like makes a good bar? And why do you think a bar is important to a community and to a city?
Well, I can say it's a responsibility. Growing up in Ireland, we're a small little island, and having travelers come from every corner of the world and tell us that we've got a wonderful country, and in turn we would invite them in to have tea or, you know, soda bread, or take them to the local pub for a pint. That made an impression on me growing up, and Doug had similar experiences. But it's the responsibility of welcoming somebody into your space and providing them with an opportunity just to get away from it all, to have a drink, have some good conversation, put the phone down, enjoy the company of the people that you're with, and maybe stay for two or three or a couple more beverages and have a great night. Go home, wake up and go to work, and then hopefully go to the pub again afterwards.
Another question back here from Kimberly. Hi. So this question is not about booze or spirits, but I'm always really fascinated about ice and the types of ice that you find in different types of drinks and the art of ice. So can you talk about what ice goes into different drinks and why?
Well, one thing that I'd like to say is that we actually have a whole ice program that is quite phenomenal. But if you go on to, I have an Instagram, Brian is less social media oriented. If you go on my Instagram, you can actually see our staff making ice for Devil's Acre. And it literally is a very arduous process of using a bandsaw and cutting ice out of a massive block. And it's an absolutely stunning work of art.
Well, I don't think Doug and I can take much credit for the ice program. There's a crew of people that work underneath our Rickhouse bar and underneath the Pagan Idol. Those are the staff of the commissary. We have a commissary, which is the wheelhouse of our business, and 7 days a week they have to produce bitters, syrups, tinctures, fresh juices, and about 10 different types of ice for 9 bars that we have around San Francisco and Berkeley. There are a couple of leaders there, Mikey and Sarah, that are tasked with this, and how they do this on a daily basis, I don't know how it gets accomplished, but we have a fleet of vehicles that have to deliver the ice, and we've learned that it's better to lease the ice making equipment than to own them, because they break down almost every single day. But it really, it's a mountain of work, but it makes all the difference in the cocktails. And definitely if somebody wanted to start their own app, it would be an ice farm somewhere down in Mission Bay, because there's demand for it.
We have a question from Vic in the center.
Hey guys, besides San Francisco, which other city do you guys have felt has done a great job with bar and cocktail culture since you guys have been involved?
Well, first and foremost, it's New York. There's been a great rivalry between New York and San Francisco when it comes to cocktail culture over the years, going back to the days of when Bourbon and Branch and Milk and Honey opened. There was a lot of cross-nation rivalry there, but since then, Chicago's done exceptionally well, and there's not a big city in the U.S. that you can't get a good cocktail in now. It's been a rising tide for every town, in every city. You'd be hard-pressed to get a bad old-fashioned or a bad mint julep in any town anywhere in the U.S. at this stage.
Yeah, and one thing that you can look at, I think, to see kind of the embracing of cocktail culture is there are a lot of conferences that are centered around around each major city that's really embracing that. Like, for example, Portland, Seattle. One that's coming up is called Tales of the Cocktail in Louisiana. And all of these really where people are just embracing cocktail culture and really acknowledging it all across the country.
Next question from up here on the risers.
So I know you bitters are kind of made a resurgence and you're hearing more and more about them. I was going to ask you guys, how important is bitters to a good cocktail? And lastly, do you guys have a favorite? What is your favorite drink?
I don't think Doug and I are the right people to speak about bitters. It's back to the ICE program. In our little organization, we have a wealth of talent that make bitters in their home kitchens and their backyards. I would say when we opened Bourbon & Branch, there might have been, you know, one major bitter brand on the market, and that was Angostura. And at our cask store here on 3rd Street, you can go in there now, and they probably have 300 different types of bitters. It's just crazy. Every flavor that you can think of, every herb, every spice has gone into a bitter at this stage, and we can't keep up. As when it comes to what are our favorite drinks, well, luckily for myself and Doug, we're spoiled. We get tasted on every new mezcal, every new tequila, every new Irish whiskey, Scotch whiskey, every new rum, every single day. If we walk into a bar, if we walk into any of our bars on any given day, our bar managers and their key staff are going to be testing and experimenting and perfecting cocktails, and they'll say, take a swig of this and tell us what you think. So there's no particular favorite. We're just spoiled rotten.
We have a question stage right from Faith.
Yeah, one last question.
No pressure. So because you have 9 bars, right? I guessed. That was right. Okay, good. So do you prefer that each of those bars stand alone in its neighborhood, or do you actually like them to be associated with future bars? Are there pros and cons to having kind of a family versus individual identity?
Absolutely. So each bar has its own personality. We call ourselves the Future Bar Group. The Future Bars Group, we have a collection of bars with a unique staff at each bar. But first and foremost, the foundation is hospitality. When you go into any of our bars, whether it's The Lark or Pagan Idol or Bourbon Branch or Turpin Reed, you should be well taken care of. You should be greeted by a friendly smile, and you should pay a fair price for a fantastic drinking experience. And how it has been beneficial for us is, for example, at the corner of Jones and O'Farrell, we have a lot of people that go to Bourbon Branch. We're open 7 nights a week. We accept reservations, and we're practically sold out every night. We're very fortunate and very lucky with that business. When those guests leave Bourbon Branch, they have 2 options. They can continue their evening at Trad or at Swig, and it's up to about 60% of guests, if they're going to go somewhere, will go to either of those 2 alternate bars. So it's worked out very well for us.
Yeah, and the other thing too is our staff have a great amount of pride in working with us, and we're very fortunate to have them working with us, but they also transfer from one location to another, and people have a lot of loyalty to certain people that they've experienced a great cocktail with, and really will kind of follow them around each one of our locations. Yeah.
Well, great. Thank you, Brian and Doug. It's an informed tradition, I'm told, to ask every speaker the following question. Brian Sheehy and Doug Dalton, what are your 60-second ideas to change the world?
Fire away. Fire away.
Well, I mean, first off would be to try our app. I think that will definitely, I think our app is going to change the world.
Well, I can say the world is going to change with the next president. Doug did not want me to talk about this, but I think we could change the world if we could get the remaining candidates to come to the Bay Area and maybe go to have them pick one of our bars to go to. I could tell you where I would suggest that they go, if you like. We could have Mr. Kasich should go to the Lark. He seems like a guy that you could have a good drink with, a good conversation, but again, it's just for a lark. It's not going to go anywhere. The next one is Hillary. Well, you know, she spent far too much time in San Francisco, and she probably should go back where she is even more welcome, and that's at Tupper and Reed, which is in Berkeley. She'll be right at home there. Mr. Trump, well, there's only one bar for him, and that's Local Edition. He probably won't pay his bill while he's there, but
he doesn't drink anyway, I don't think so.
Exactly. That's why he's also not going to pick up the tab. But, you know, he will be as close to the seat of William Randolph Hearst as he'll probably ever get, and that was quite the bully pulpit. And then we have Ted Cruz. Well, our apothecary bar would probably do well with his demons. That's the devil's acre. We have a lot of medicinal potions up there from, I would recommend the sherry cobbler. That would chill him out a little bit. And then who's the last one? Oh, Bernie. Bernie. How could I forget Bernie? Well, there's only one bar for him also, and that's Bourbon and Branch, because he'll remember that he was there when he was 21 during Prohibition. Is that safe enough, Doug?
Very safe.
Well, thanks, everybody, for coming out. It's a very lively discussion. Hang around afterwards, and we'll all be hanging around.